This is VOA News. I'm Michael Brown. Russian forces are expanding their attacks on Ukrainian border settlements close to the northeastern city of Kharkiv, opening up a new front in the war as Kyiv struggles to hold off a renewed Russian offensive. With U.S. and European weapons finally due to arrive on the front lines in the coming weeks following delays, can Ukraine hold back Moscow's invading troops? Henry Ridgewell has more.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky arrived in Kharkiv Thursday, having cancelled all foreign travel. Kyiv said its defensive moves had slowed the speed of Moscow's advance. Ukrainian forces are still waiting for the bulk of the weapons deliveries under the United States. Analysts say Russia has been able to rebuild its military strength over the past 6 months with the help of China, Iran, and North Korea. And that makes any future Ukrainian offensive more difficult. Henry Ridgewell, VOA News.
A U.S.-built pier is in place to bring humanitarian aid to Gaza by sea, but no one will know if the new route will work until a steady stream of deliveries begins reaching starving Palestinians. The U.S. Agency for International Development's Sonali Khoury says security is a concern.
There is a very insecure operating environment. And the deconfliction measures are not where they need to be yet, given the complexity of the environment. So those conversations are ongoing. They need to continue, and they need to get to a place where humanitarian aid workers feel safe and secure and able to operate safely. And I don't think we're there yet.
Meantime, for more news, we invite you to join us at our website, voanews.com. This is VOA News. In other news, the AP's Karen Chamas reports on the health of Slovakia's prime minister after an assassination attempt.
Slovak authorities have charged a man with attempting to assassinate populist Prime Minister Robert Fico, saying the suspect acted alone. Interior Minister Matúš Šutaj-Eztok said that the investigation found that the assassination was clearly a politically motivated act. The minister did not specify what the motivation was, but blamed media outlets and the opposition. His victory led to thousands of people on the streets across Slovakia to protest many policies, including taking control of public media. I'm Karen Chamas.
The Justice Department has arrested three people in connection with a North Korean identity theft scheme involving thousands of IT workers. We get the latest from the AP's Lisa Dwyer.
The Justice Department says that the complex stolen identity scheme generates enormous proceeds for the North Korean government, including for its weapons program. The scheme involves thousands of North Korean information technology workers who prosecutors say are dispatched by the North Korean government to live abroad, with those workers relying on the stolen identities of Americans to obtain remote employment at U.S.-based Fortune 500 companies. Those IT jobs then give them access to sensitive corporate data and lucrative paychecks. Officials say the fraud is a way for heavily sanctioned North Korea, which is cut off from the U.S. financial system, to take advantage of a high-tech labor shortage and the proliferation of remote telework. I'm Lisa Dwyer.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, again denied arms exchanges with Russia, state media KCNA reported on Friday. The U.S. and South Korea accused North Korea of transferring weapons to Russia for use against Ukraine, which it invaded in February of 2022. Both Moscow and Pyongyang have denied the accusations but vowed last year to deepen military relations. AP correspondent Donna Water reports on how some long-term effects of last year's deadly wildfires in Maui still exist.
Researchers say 74% of those who participated in a University of Hawaii study examining the health effects of the deadly wildfires may have difficulty breathing and otherwise poor respiratory health. Almost half show signs of compromised lung function. The study looked at 679 people in January and February, but researchers hope to eventually enroll 2,000 people to generate what they call a snapshot of the estimated 10,000 people affected by the fires.
Donna Water reporting, and I'm Michael Brown. This is VOA News.
America. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barkey in Washington. Today is Friday, May 17th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The U.S. and Niger conclude high-level talks on Thursday on plans to withdraw all U.S. military forces from the country.
We're going to continue to stay engaged with the partners in the region when it comes to terrorism and countering the terrorist threat. Because again, you know, I think we all collectively can work together to address those very real threats.
A new report calls for arms embargo on Sudan for alleged ethnic cleansing. War in Sudan impacts neighboring South Sudan's ability to sell its oil. Ghanaian civil groups push to expose corruption. Chad's main opposition responds to the announcement of the final election results.
Regardless of the outcome, I believe we have exhausted any legal route. So now the battle remains in the political route. So we need to have the discussion.
And Republican voters are urged to chip away at the Democrats' mail-in voting advantage. And those stories plus Samson O'Malley Sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. U.S. and Nigerian leaders concluded official high-level talks on Thursday on plans to withdraw all American military forces from the country, a U.S. military official told VOA. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carl Babb has more on how the withdrawal affects the fight against terrorism in the region.
A U.S. military official has told VOA that U.S. and Nigerian leaders agreed American forces will begin a phased withdrawal from Niger in the coming months after being in the country for over a decade. The official added that participants in negotiations this week confirmed protections and immunities for U.S. personnel. Officials in Niger also approved diplomatic clearances for the withdrawal flights to ensure smooth entries and exits during the pullout of U.S. forces, who were in the country to help local militaries combat Islamist terrorists in the Sahel.
Countries like Mali, like Niger, like Nigeria, Burkina Faso, these have seen an expansive rise in jihadist movements. These are some of the most dangerous areas in the world.
The United States spent more than $100 million building a drone base near the central Nigerian city of Agadez to surveil Al-Qaeda, the Islamic State, and other terror groups. Because of the withdrawal, the U.S. base will end its drone surveillance there about 5 years after drone operations began.
Niger was somewhat of a rarity in the sense that it had one of the few democratically elected governments in the region, and also a democratically elected government that was friendly to the U.S. and willing to host a U.S. military presence. And so finding a replacement for that, for a military base, is going to be somewhat difficult.
Martinez McKine says the U.S. will likely reach out to neighboring Chad to base more American troops following Chad's presidential election earlier this month. Chad and the U.S. are currently reviewing their security cooperation agreements.
We're going to continue to stay engaged with the partners in the region when it comes to terrorism and countering the terrorist threat. Because, again, you know, I think we all collectively can work together to address those very real threats.
The withdrawal is seen as a huge blow to the U.S. counter-terror fight. Without bases in the Sahel, U.S. drones will need to fly from thousands of miles away to keep an eye on terror groups wreaking havoc in the region. Carla Babb, VOA News, the Pentagon.
Chad's prime minister and the leading opposition candidate in the May 6 election has called on Chadians to remain united and build the country's future. Success Masra of the Transformers Party spoke to his supporters on Thursday, soon after the Constitutional Council declared interim president Mahamat Idris Debi the winner of the May 6 election. Dolemba Jasada is the Transformers vice president for political affairs and the diaspora. He tells me the party will take the fight into parliamentary and local elections.
As you can see from what was given a couple of days ago and compared to today's result, nothing has really changed. And the reason why we kept on pushing from the first preliminary result to this last one is simply because we have judiciary route that we could use, and that's what we did. Unfortunately, the Constitutional Council did not consider any of our points, so therefore they declare President Mahamat Idris Debi winner of this election. Regardless of the outcome, I believe we have exhausted any legal route, so now the battle remains in the political route, so we need to have this discussion. with the other team and in order to figure out how to move forward, because there are many more elections coming up, legislative, governorates, and all the different communal elections coming up. We believe that we are the most popular one.
The Prime Minister spoke to the people today. He mentioned here that the truth always triumphs in the end, and that the truth is that change is irreversible and its implementation will depend on all of us. What do you think he means now?
Yeah, as you can say, this is a very historic election in Chad, given the number of people that came out to vote. The turnout is unbelievable. So if people came out that much to vote, it means they are determined for a change. But it seems that we're in a statu quo. So in order to respond to the need of the people and to the desire of the people, since democracy is the will of the people, the power of the people, then there's no other option than having this frank political discussion in order for the people to triumph. Otherwise, it will not be a good mandate for him, in the sense that the people of Chad, as we speak, if it's reflecting what is it being said, there should be celebration all over the country. But the climate is very, very timid. That means something. I don't know what exactly that means, but it means probably that the people of Chad is not really happy about the outcome of this election. But this should not stop at this point. There is an opportunity to change this, and that depends on the dialogue that will be coming up between the involving parties as we're part of it on a political discussion that we'll be having the days to come.
So some members of your party were arrested and I think in prison. The Prime Minister, what did he have to say about those people?
They should be free, period. There is no reason to arrest anybody. Those are political pressure, as you can see it. And we are used to this. In fact, I myself have gone to prison before in the past. And those are political pressure that has been used, but this has no effect whatsoever on the determination of people that desire change. And we should be part of the change that's coming. Otherwise, it's not what the people want. So they should be free, and we believe in the days to come, it should be released.
Dolemba Jesada is the Vice President for Political Affairs and the Diaspora of Chad's opposition, the Transformers Party. He was speaking with me from N'Djamena, Chad. A 2023 Transparency International report found that most African nations have shown little progress in the fight against government corruption. Civil society groups in Ghana, however, are taking up the challenge to expose corruption and push for action. Isaac Chalizi has more from the capital, Accra.
These Ghanaian journalists work for the Fourth Estate, an Accra-based non-profit public interest and accountability investigative journalism project by the Media Foundation for West Africa. Kofi Angel is the editor of the Fourth Estate.
We work with Ghanaians, we work with whistleblowers who give us information. And so we look at issues and we go deep into those issues.
Since its launch in 2021, the Fourth Estate has published several anti-graft stories, including an expose on how many public officials were failing to follow a 1998 law requiring them to declare their assets.
When we published the story, and we thought that that was simple, and it sent the right message to authorities and to public officials.
A 2023 report by the anti-corruption group Transparency International says most African countries are failing to make progress against corruption. And Ghanaian activists say their country too isn't doing enough to stop the problem. Mary Awelina Adi is the executive director of Ghana Integrity Initiative.
There are so many gaps within the system that we haven't paid attention to. And for that matter, it makes the fight against corruption a difficult one.
Some of those gaps include weak laws that hinder the investigation and prosecution of corrupt public officials. Civil society groups like the Ghana Center for Democratic Development are filling the gap. In 2017, the center launched the Corruption Watch Project. Kojo Pumpuni Asante is the center's director of advocacy and policy engagement.
We are able to do original investigations. We have actual investigative journalists as part of the team that do the investigation. But we also try to follow up on cases that are alive or cases that we feel have been buried and we forgotten.
Thanks to the works of these civil society groups, there is a vibrant fight against corruption in the country. Isaac Kalaji, VOA News, Accra.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, May 17th. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And still to come on our program, Samson O'Malley Sports. A new report by Human Rights Watch has called on the United Nations and African Union to place an arms embargo on Sudan amid ongoing ethnic cleansing in Darfur. Henry Wilkins speaks to the author of the report, who says the response by the international community has been disappointing.
A May 9th report by Human Rights Watch details what it says is the ongoing ethnic cleansing being carried out by the Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, and its allied militants in the Darfur region of Sudan. The report says the RSF, an ethnic Arab paramilitary group, has targeted the non-Arab Masalit people, killing thousands, although the report did not specify how many. The UN says about 8.8 million people have fled their homes in Sudan since the fighting broke out in April of last year. The report calls on the United Nations and the African Union to implement an arms embargo on Sudan to help prevent further violence.
There are many lessons learned that the international regional community seems not to grasp or move forward into action to prevent further atrocities. We've been raising the alarm bell, even, as I mentioned, you know, from 2020 onward, on the ongoing attacks on civilians. And we haven't seen a proper response from the international community.
Osman says neither the UN nor the African Union had acted on the report.
But so far we haven't seen any movement or response from these entities towards the recommendations that we provided.
The African Union did not respond to VOA's request for an interview, nor did the office of the UN Secretary-General's personal envoy to Sudan. In April, UN Secretary-General Antonio Guterres said crimes against humanity may have been committed in Darfur and has since expressed grave concern about the ongoing fighting. Osman, meanwhile, expressed his frustration.
I think we need to have a conversation around the moral and political responsibility at the same time, because you can't come forward saying you stand with the people of Sudan and continue to express your solidarity, but in terms of action, when people need it, you're not going forward with that.
Osman says the international community must work together to end the crisis, bringing those responsible to account, aside from implementing an embargo.
I think bringing Darfur and the situation in Sudan to the focus on the agenda, you know, engaging with the Sudanese stakeholders, not only the political or the military elites, you know, talking to civilian groups, you know, talking to civil society, talking to the displaced and refugee communities.
A UN peacekeeping force that had been sent to Darfur after the 2003 genocide left the region in 2021, prompting a renewal in the targeting of Masalit and other black ethnic groups. Analysts say the civil war that began in Sudan last year has made matters worse and led to a breakdown in law and order. Henry Wilkins, VOA News.
The International Crisis Group says South Sudan faces an economic meltdown because of the war in neighboring Sudan. In its latest report, the group says Sudan's civil war has severely disrupted South Sudan's oil exports. Daniel Akech is the Crisis Group's senior analyst for South Sudan. He talks to me about the impact of South Sudan's inability to sell its oil.
It did not come as a surprise that there is a oil pipeline rupture as a result of the ongoing war in the neighboring Sudan. It was expected as the war progresses that there will be a inflow or a spillover of violence into South Sudan, as well as the heavy reliance of South Sudanese government on oil was going to create a problem if the war prolongs, and it has been prolonging now more than a year. So far. So this was expected. The impact is huge. because the South Sudanese government depends on oil for more than 80% of its revenues comes from oil. So though there are two pipelines that carry oil from the south into the international market through Sudan, and one of them, which generates about 60% of the oil revenues for South Sudan, has been damaged since February this year. Also, South Sudanese economy, the local market and the local currency are reacting in a way that is alarming for the civilians. And this is also affecting not just the market prices, because South Sudan imports, say, like 40% of its cereals come from Uganda and Kenya. And so the whole economy is, it depends on dollars because of the heavy imports of food commodities. Those are affected by the collapse of oil revenue.
With so many things about to happen this year in South Sudan, particularly they are thinking about election, the issue of financial support, how much impact would that have on South Sudan going ahead with what it has to do for this year?
Yes, the economic crisis has pretty much connected with the other factors, one of which is the political process. Some of these agreements that parties do sign, fueled by oil, if you have a coalition government, it depends on its salaries, which are coming from the oil revenue. If you no longer have those, it actually affects the already existing coalition government, which came about from the 2018 peace agreement. So that is one implication. And then you have the forces that are pending to be unified, and those forces would need resources to be able to move that process forward. And that will be already affected. And you have the constitution-making process, which was about to something that ought to be done before elections. The time is running out. So a lot of things that were pending that are required as prerequisite to be done before the December election cannot be done because of this worsening economic situation.
Daniel Akech is the International Crisis Group's senior analyst for South Sudan. U.S. voters have several ways to cast their ballots in a presidential election, including by mail. Many Democrats have embraced mail-in voting, and now Republicans are being urged by party leaders, including former President Donald Trump, to use all voting options in the 2024 general election. VOA's Veronica Balderas Iglesias has the details.
Enthusiasm about the November general election in the United States is average among voters, according to a recent Gallup poll. But it's a right that some people told VOA Spanish should not be taken for granted. Duke University student Pilar Kelly.
Voting is kind of the most fundamental way of making your voice heard.
Republican voter Jenny Wilson said people must vote for things that will help the country. Americans can vote in person on Election Day or early at special polling locations. They can also send their ballots via the U.S. Postal Service. Will Adler is with the Bipartisan Policy Center. He was interviewed via Skype.
Every state in the country allows some form of mail-in voting. The way that they differ is in how much they require an excuse, such as the voter being away from their home or their polling place on Election Day.
Where states offer vote-by-mail programs instead of absentee ones, registered voters receive their ballots automatically before Election Day. Social distancing measures at the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic boosted mail-in voting. More Democrats than Republicans embraced it during the 2020 and 2022 election cycles, according to Pew Research surveys. The messaging by President Joe Biden on the matter has been consistent throughout the years.
Voting by mail is a safe and convenient way to get more people to vote.
Biden's predecessor, Donald Trump, who is again running for president, has repeatedly expressed concern that voting by mail could lead to fraud.
Absentee is good. Mail-in universal is very, very bad. There's no way they're going to get it accurately.
Since 2023, however, several Republican politicians have stressed the need for the electorate to use all forms of voting. Trump has also shown an openness to it. On May 9th, he stressed on his Truth Social platform that, quote, absentee voting, early voting, and election day voting are all good options. Groups trying to mobilize Republican voters say they want to chip away at the voting-by-mail advantage Democrats have established. Max Doxey, political director for the Republican State Leadership Committee via Skype.
The more voters that we can bring to the table in early voting and absentee voting in vote-by-mail through our efforts, the better position we'll be going into election night.
The Democratic Legislative Campaign Committee told VOA in a statement it doubts the Republican voters will be persuaded to shift their views. The committee also warned about legislation being considered by state Republicans to block mail-in ballots with minor errors and ban ballot drop boxes. Experts say it isn't easy to predict how voting by mail could impact this year's election result. Michael McDonald, professor of political science at the University of Florida, via Skype.
If you make mail balloting easier, then you do see higher turnout. It's not clear that there's a strong effect on the partisan outcomes, but because, again, even Republicans will want to vote and they'll find ways of voting.
McDonald expressed confidence that the safeguards that election officials have in place will reduce the already historically small chances of fraudulent votes being cast in a presidential election. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News, Washington.
For Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson Umale in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you too, James. We begin the sport with basketball. Nigeria's representatives at the 2024 Basketball Africa League, Rivers Hoopers, will face AS Douanes of Senegal in one of the four seeding games in the playoffs in Kigali next week. Unlike previous formats where teams advanced straight to the knockout stage, teams have been paired based on their performance across all three conferences in this season's playoffs. The winner between Hoopers and AS Douanes will play against the winner between Petro de Luanda and US Monaster, while the loser of the tie will square up against the loser of Game 39 in the quarterfinal. The seeding games will take place on the 24th and the 25th of May before the quarterfinals tip off on Sunday the 26th of May at the BK Arena in Kigali. In football news, World Football Governing Body FIFA says it wants all of its national federations to make racist abuse a disciplinary offense. It detailed the tougher approach to tackle racism on Thursday after months of consulting with victimized players, including Brazilian forward Vinicius Jr. The measures will be put to FIFA member federations on Friday as they gather in the Thai capital of Bangkok for their annual meeting. They include mandatory sanctions, possible match forfeits, actions on the field, and potential criminal charges. Staying with football news, Esperance will host Egyptian giant Al Ahly in the first leg of a final of the CAF Champions League on Saturday. The stakes are high as both teams vie for the title, with the Tunisian side seeking to capitalize on their home advantage against the formidable Al Ahly side in Tunis. Esperance will be eager to secure the first leg victory against Al Ahly, while the Egyptian giants aim to assert their dominance before the return leg. The clash sees a meeting between the two teams with the most CAF Champions League final appearances, with ES Tunis set to play in their 8th final and Al Ahly in their 14th. No other side has appeared in more than 5. In rugby news, Kenyan national women's rugby sevens team, the Lionesses, are upbeat of finishing in top 4 at the final HSBC Challenger Series leg in Krakow, Poland, in their bid to make the cut for the final round of the HSBC World Rugby Sevens Series qualifiers. Head coach Dennis Mwanja believes his charges have hit top form and will be ready to row during the weekend's crunch action in Poland. And now to cricket, where Cricket South Africa has come under criticism for its selection of the T20 World Cup 2024 squad, which includes only one black African player, Kagiso Rabada. The decision has sparked concerns about the regression in the country's effort towards achieving transformation in cricket. And that's it for this Friday's edition of Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. And I am James Butte in Washington.